From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. On this week's show, a look at those who continue to support Missouri Republican Todd Akin in the Senate race, even after his embarrassing remarks concerning rape.
It is very difficult for me to see someone who was supporting Congressman Akin jumping ship to Claire McCaskill because they diverge on so many other issues.
Plus, a walk through the studio of local artist Jim Leedy.
Now, I don't know what that piece is going to look like. It creates itself, sort of, by telling me what to do.
And a local urban rapper makes the shift to healthy hip-hop.
It really goes back to the home and trying to find a way to encourage our parents to really get involved with their children.
I tell you right now, the sky's the limit. You gotta work hard from the start to finish.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
GOP leadership continues to pressure Republican Todd Akin to withdraw from the U.S. Senate race in Missouri. Akin embarrassed the party when he said women's bodies can block pregnancy in cases of so-called, quote, legitimate rape, unquote. Akin has long since apologized. And as KCUR's Frank Morris reports, a lot of people in Missouri are still backing Akin, some more strongly than before.
Todd Akin was polling ahead of the incumbent, Democrat Claire McCaskill, but Akin's support fractured into several distinct camps after his legitimate rape comment. Fireworks explode over downtown Kansas City in a show promoted by a conservative Christian radio station. Mary Bennett here has been watching the firestorm over Todd Akin, too.
I've never been a real fan of McCaskill. So when Akin came in, I was kind of looking at him going, you know, he's a conservative. He's not going to maybe overspend. Let's keep an eye on him. But, you know, he made himself look really stupid.
It's pushed Bennett into the undecided column. She's lost faith in Akin's judgment, and she's not the only one.
I frankly think that he's very out of touch.
Gina Townley, all decked out in red, white, and blue, says she has personal reasons to disagree with Akin's position on rape and pregnancy.
My mother was raped and left for dead. I wish women did get pregnant from rape, but that's just not the way it works.
Abortion, however, is not Townley's top issue. She's among those backing Akin despite reservations.
I support a conservative government. So if a Republican candidate fits that bill, then I will be leaning towards that candidate.
The GOP establishment really wants that candidate to be somebody other than Todd Akin. This race is key to their plan to take over the U.S. Senate. Political groups have invested millions blasting the incumbent with negative ads. Victory seemed at hand. Susie Spalty says Akin blew it and should step aside, but if he doesn't...
It's going to be really hard, but I'd vote for him if he stayed in the race. I would almost vote for Alfred E. Newman. If Akin stays in, then I will probably vote for him, much to my chagrin. I don't want to.
None of this surprises George Connor, who teaches political science at Missouri Southern University.
It is very difficult for me to see someone who was supporting Congressman Akin jumping ship to Claire McCaskill because they diverge on so many other issues.
Everything from abortion to funding for school lunches. Akin has sunk substantially in the polls, especially among independents. But Connor says that what Akin loses in the middle of the political spectrum, he may gain on the right.
And ultimately, I think this controversy will help Congressman Akin more than it hurts him.
Because it's rallied some of Akin's strongest supporters. Members of a motorcycle club show off their bikes at a veterans benefit in Kansas City. Myrna Minky says the controversy over Akin has revved up her rebellious streak.
It actually made me angry. I'm just tired of a group of elites always telling the average citizen what to think and who to vote for, and it was overblown. I thought it was ridiculous, and no, I still support him.
And that anger stretches from Missouri all the way to the Republican nominating convention in Tampa, according to Joan Langenberg, who's been there with the Missouri Eagle Forum.
Unfortunately, it's really divided the Republican Party. Into those who would demonize Representative Aiken and those who were behind him.
Some Missouri delegates had plastered Aiken for Senate stickers on their clothes in defiance of party leaders. Langenberg says many Missouri voters have accepted Aiken's apologies for his statement. They've forgiven him, and they admire his backbone.
Absolutely right. I mean, he is standing up to the biggest lynch mob that I've ever seen.
Here we go. Runners, to your marks, go!
Back in Kansas City, the Senate race seems to be getting up and running again, same as this foot race to benefit veterans at Liberty Memorial. Aiken is generating lots of small contributions. Todd Hill, who's here to see his wife compete in the race, says he did not vote for Aiken in the GOP primary, that the controversy has amped up his level of enthusiasm for Aiken.
It solidified my support for him. I'm much stronger for Aiken now than I was before because he stands up for what he believes in.
Aiken claims hundreds of new contributors in the last couple of weeks. Dale Austin says it would be a mistake to count him out.
You know, you see funny things, but people that hang in there and are able to say, I'm sorry, you know. I think the people have an amazing capacity to forgive. So I think he's got a chance.
After all, Aiken's base is fired up. And the political organizations that have spent heavily pounding Clara McCaskill with negative ads have millions of dollars worth of airtime still reserved to renew the attack when the time is right. Frank Morris, KCUR News.
In spite of numbers that reflect a slight decrease in the problem of hunger in our community, nonprofits and on-site meal service venues are not seeing a parallel drop in demand. In fact, agencies have seen a continued, if not increased, demand in spite of small improvements in the economy. And that means Harvesters, the local community food bank, also needs to collect more food supplies to distribute to the some 600 organizations and venues in the 16-county area it serves.
One of our community's most well-respected advocates for those in need is stepping down next year as executive director of Harvesters. And she sat down with KCUR's Laura Ziegler to talk about the current state of affairs at Harvesters. Kansas City is part of a network of 200 similar food banks across the country.
My name is Karen Heron. I am the president and CEO for Harvesters, the community food network. I have been involved with Harvesters for 26 years. I will be leaving July of 2013.
A recent Gallup poll indicated that what's called food hardship has slightly decreased in the last year, tenths of a percentage point, I think 18.6 to 18.2% nationwide. I mean, I'm wondering, as a provider, as a food bank, how you all measure what the need is locally.
We do use the USDA information about food insecurity. We also have, through Feeding America, our national network of food banks, we do extensive in-depth interviews, both at the agency level and with families receiving food assistance. Then we also use what we call Map the Meal Gap that tells us how many meals are needed, where are those meals coming from, and what's the gap. So I do believe it is the efforts of all of those organizations working very hard. It's also because SNAP and the federal commodities programs are available. So there's a lot at work here to help address those issues.
Congress was set to pass a new farm bill this year. If passed as it was written, the House and Senate versions of the bill would cut billions of dollars in benefits and in food assistance, the so-called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. How would this affect Harvesters?
Any cuts to SNAP, which is the current term for the food stamp program, would have significant impact on those we provide food to and on Harvesters. First of all, SNAP, as it currently exists, does not meet all the need of those families for food assistance. So they come to a pantry or a shelter for additional assistance beyond the SNAP assistance they receive. Then we also provide food to many families where they don't meet the criteria to receive the SNAP benefits, but still have a significant need for food assistance. So if there were any cuts in the SNAP program, what that would mean is there would be a greater need amongst those we're already serving, but there would be an increased number of people as well.
The Senate version is calling for something like over $2 billion in cuts, and the House version, $16.5 billion in cuts. I'm just wondering, With that great a cut in these assistance programs, if it might be that people who donate to Harvesters would see a greater need and be inspired to maybe give more, and if that's happened in the past, is it enough to offset the greater need created by the cuts?
There is no way that the nonprofit sector could offset cuts in the SNAP program. And just to give you a small example, if you look at it on a national basis, there's 200 and some food banks all across the country. Our collective value of food that we distribute is $5 billion. Collectively, that's 200 food banks all across the country. The SNAP program is $70 billion a year. So if you cut 16 out of the SNAP program, just hypothetically, that's tripling what food banks are currently doing.
National unemployment rate now stands at something like 8.3, I think, mm-hmm. percent. Kansas and Missouri have significantly lower. I think it's 6.3 in Kansas and 7.2%, I believe, in Missouri. I'm wondering whether or not you all have seen an impact in the lowering unemployment rate on your work.
Well, primarily what we've seen, particularly since 2008, is the request for food assistance has gone up and it has stayed high, and we haven't seen it come down in terms of, you know, the unemployment has dropped a little bit, but we have not seen that mean that there is a reduction in requests for assistance. And I think there's a couple of factors at play. One, sometimes people give up and drop out of the unemployment numbers. They stop looking for jobs, so they would not be in those unemployment numbers. The other thing it doesn't capture is people who have taken jobs, but those jobs are at lesser wages, lesser benefits, lesser number of hours even. We do see a higher percentage of people working in our area, and that was borne out in our hunger study, but we also see that they're not working at jobs that provide benefits. If you're working at a minimum wage job, you can't support a family on a minimum wage job, even if you're working two minimum wage jobs. So we really see the underemployed, they're just not making enough to stretch it to meet housing, food, car. I mean, all the things that you have for a family to function.
What do you think when you're driving along the street and you see some of these men and women at the corners that say, we'll work for food or need food?
You know, I just think about how difficult it is for them. You know, when you have to ask for food assistance, it's pretty challenging. You know, I've talked to a lot of the parents who have to ask for food assistance to feed their child, and it's pretty hard. You know, if you can't feed your children, how tough is that?
Well, does it reflect, do you think, a lack of services? Does it mean there aren't enough places for those individuals to go to get a meal?
I think there are places for individuals to go to get a meal. And there are several different ways to access where food is available in the community. Through the United Way, 211, someone can call into that number and just enter their information, and they can find somewhere close to them. So all of the information is out there, and there are places to access food.
Harvester's Executive Director Karen Herron. She spoke with KCUR's Laura Ziegler. We'll have a map of the 16-county area Harvester serves and some of the agencies who take advantage of Harvester's resources on our website at kcur.org.
Coming up, step inside the studio of local artist Jim Leedy. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Samuel Clemens, who is said to have taken his pen name Mark Twain from the cries of riverboat crewmen, found the inspiration for his classic works while growing up in the river town of Hannibal, Missouri. Today, more than 125 years after the first pressing of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, there's a new set of artistic characters in Twain's boyhood home. KWMU's Tim Lloyd has this story.
Standing at Hannibal's town dock, I can hear old calliope music from a steamboat lumbering into town. Looking uphill from the bank of the Mississippi River, it's hard to remember Hannibal was almost gutted by a massive flood in 1993. After the waters receded and life got back to normal, a steady influx of artists has slowly given the 177-year-old town a new feel. On Saturday afternoon, you can find a few of them holding a bohemian roundtable of sorts. at Java Jives, the local coffee house. Steve Ayers, a potter with a Mark Twain-like mustache, seems to know just about every artist in town. Stepping outside onto Main Street where a street musician is playing steel guitar, he talks about the effort 14 years ago to recruit other artists to live here.
I started thinking about it. I came here in 85, and it's a great little town. So I always thought it would be a great place for artists to live, and there weren't any here. So more than anything else, we did it just because I'm lonesome. You know, you wanted somebody to share a beer with.
The sales pitch was something like, come to Hannibal, it's cheap to live here and easy to get to art shows. The project to formally recruit artists has faded over the years, but Ayer says that's not really a bad thing.
It works much better when it happens kind of naturally, kind of, you know, when friends invite friends in. When you were doing an active recruitment, you had all these people coming in who always wanted to be artists, and they were never happy. When you had friends, they invited in people they liked. And it just worked much better.
He has plenty of company now. There are nearly 50 active artists in this little town of 18,000. Their presence here has changed the complexion of Main Street. A quarter of its storefronts are now occupied by artists. Many of the shops here specialize in the kind of accessible folk art that appeals to tourists who've come here to see Mark Twain's hometown. And the community has rallied around them. The Art Council's budget has tripled. Some banks and the hospital have ditched corporate art and now decorate their walls with local work. The door to Nancy Kaufman's shop is propped open today, and you can hear a train howling by in the distance. Kaufman is threading turquoise, magenta, deep blue yarn through a 6-foot-long loom. Kaufman was a fixture of the art scene in Santa Fe for 30 years and co-owned two galleries there. But in 2005, she decided to take some time away from the art show circuit and set up a little shop on Main Street in downtown Hannibal.
And when I first moved here, I said, you know, this place reminds me of Santa Fe when I moved there in 1976, because Santa Fe then, it was dead all winter long, and we only had a couple months, you know, of tourism. But right now, it just has a feeling of, you know, something that's right at the beginning of its growth.
As soon as she saw this old drugstore on Main Street, she dreamed of turning it into a place where she could weave and talk to customers.
To bring something to life, you know, back to life, and to give it new life. It's creativity, you know, it's a birth. It's exciting to us. I think that's just the nature of the artist.
Most artists in Hannibal, though, don't own shops and make their money traveling to art shows. Being located near the center of the Midwest makes it more convenient to get to those shows. Melissa Dominiak is a painter who moved here from Seattle. She's now in the process of rehabbing a massive former church.
It's shaped almost like a clover leaf, I would say. I'm guessing the vaults are 35, 40 feet high. There's a house next door, and there's an empty lot on the side of the house. And this church was $70,000. That's what we bought it for.
She says she'll put her studio here and try and rent out the rest of the space for special events. Like many of the artists here, Dominiak says Hannibal's central location, affordability, and a thriving arts community make being a struggling artist just a little less painful.
That story was from KWMU's Tim Lloyd. If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
And last week's Casey Kearns episode was a special late-night edition that explored the region between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. You can see pictures of gigged frogs, late-night pie, and much more online at kcur.org. And now it's time for My Farm Roots, a series by Harvest Public Media. These are American stories and memories of rural life. Harvest Public Media's Camille Phillips has the latest installment.
I met Barb and Lynn Handy on an August morning at their farmhouse in Percival, Iowa. When the Missouri River flooded last year, they were left with fish swimming in their basement. But other than the sand drifts against the house, you'd never know it now. Decades of farming the river bottoms have taught them to float through life's ups and downs and take the time to enjoy each other's company.
I'm Barb Handy.
I'm Lynn Handy, and we live in Percival, Iowa.
We've been married for 52 years. We have two daughters.
That's a long time.
That is a long time.
We did a lot of dancing, and you go to Peony Park in Omaha. They had a big, you know, big bands, and always enjoyed that, so.
Well, I'm sure Lynn took others there before I started dating him. But it was nice. It was all new to me, so it was nice. Very romantic. My mother probably made me a special dress for the occasion.
I can remember the trumpets up there would knock you, you know, about five of them, and they'd knock you down out on the floor, you know, they really. And I still, that music, it's funny how your music gets in you. We have a better radio in the car now, and it'll pick up satellite. And one station in there is all big band music, you know. And it's funny how the minute it comes on, that music is different to you than any of the other music, you know. And I suppose every generation has their music, you know. So I still like it the best.
We always like Deep Purple, like to dance to Deep Purple. It's just a romantic song, and it's a slow song, so that's why we like it. The Glenn Miller Festival is in Clarinda, which is just east of here. So every year, this is my date for the year that we can dance, because we still like to dance. Last year, we didn't get to because of the flood. This year, when it was on, you know, I get so excited. For a whole week, I'm thinking, oh, Saturday night, we're going to the dance. Len came in about 4 o'clock and said, oh, I don't think I can go to the dance. Apparently a tongue from a wagon or something had dropped on his foot.
Trailer fell there. I didn't put that.
Anyway, it dropped on his foot. We did go over to the dance for a short while and watch. But I will say, the next morning we went to church, his limp was not quite so pronounced. But it was swollen and it was black and blue. But I was kind of defeated about that one.
Got out of that dance, didn't I?
To hear more of My Farm Root stories or to share your own, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroots.
The Crossroads, a once blighted area in downtown Kansas City, is now a thriving arts district. But in the early 1980s, it was full of abandoned warehouses and known simply as Leedyville, a nod to artist Jim Leedy, who encouraged other artists to set up studios and business owners to move in. After years of starts and stops, a new film documenting Leedy's past and present recently made its debut. KCUR's Laura Spencer reports.
Stephanie Leedy, with blonde bangs, sits in the Leedy Volkas Art Center, the light-filled crossroads gallery named for ceramic artist Peter Volkas and her father, Jim Leedy.
He was just enough of a visionary. He could see that there was a future for down here.
Artist Jim Leedy was lured to Kansas City in 1966 to join the Kansas City Art Institute's sculpture department. Here he continued a pattern that began in an earlier teaching gig in Montana, renting space in the early 70s to show work by students and colleagues. But when his rent in Westport rose from about $500 to $5,000 a month, he was priced out. In the 1980s, Leedy started looking for another location.
Looked all over town, looked at the bottoms, looked down and the market and whatever. And every time I was going through this thing by area near the Brown Center, and though it was blighted, I thought, well, it's too close to Crown Center and so on. Nothing would be cheap enough to get. So I tried it one day, and I bought a building for very, very cheap.
In an area called Leedyville, Freight House District, and more often these days, the Crossroads Arts District, Jim Leedy bought more buildings and established studio spaces for artists, an art gallery, and a community, all while creating his own art, sculptures, prints, paintings, public art, and teaching.
Where do you see yourself going now?
As a teacher, like in this critique session for Kansas City Art Institute seniors, Leedy didn't sugarcoat his response to a student's work, white ceramic birds in a nest of vines on a stump. He tempered criticism with praise. Leedy's advice to always be conscious of where you've been when heading in a new direction.
You know, so it's all a growth. And from piece to piece, even though they're vastly different in design, they are the result of everything that has happened in your exploration.
Artist Kevin McGraw met Jim Leedy in the mid-1980s as a student at the University of Kansas. McGraw says he started to consider the idea of a film after the book Artist Across Boundaries about Leedy's life and work was released in 2000. He says he knew there were more stories to tell.
There's just so much work and there's so much of his heart and soul in Kansas City and in the Crossroads that I just think people needed to see that. And I just felt really compelled to do it. And I just really felt like it just needed to be done.
Several years later, McGraw teamed up with Wide Awake Films, a company specializing in history, mostly Civil War documentaries. Matt Hawley was brought on as editor and Kevin Worley as a writer and producer. Worley describes Leedy as a gentle person with an ornery streak.
Until you meet him in person, it's hard to really understand the warmth and the charisma and the inspiration that he projects.
The crew sifted through old photographs, recorded interviews, and collected footage of crowds at First Fridays. In 2007, a trailer premiered on the public television station, KCPT.
First and foremost, he's an artist.
Jim is the father figure to many of the artists in our community.
Jim caught me way off guard. I've never seen anything like it.
He put helping other people as the center of his life.
A lot of times Jim is so busy trying to lift other people up, he sometimes doesn't take care of himself.
We're very fortunate to still keep him here.
I'm in there to create a community.
But then the financial and economic crash of 2008. Kevin McGraw says fundraising was tough.
The bottom dropped out of the economy, and I was having fundraising parties, and there was no funds getting raised. So that slowed things down.
In the spring of 2008, Jim Leedy retired from the Kansas City Art Institute. Kevin Worley returned to school to earn a master's to teach, inspired in part by Leedy. In late 2010, McGraw says he started the conversation again with Matt Hawley, the original editor, who is now working on his own, and things started to progress. McGraw says he was determined not to quit and set a date in 2012 for the film to premiere.
At this frustration point, when it was about the highest, I just told Jim, I go, August 31st. And then I go, oops, I didn't ask Matt yet. He has just been absolutely fantastic, Matt. He just stayed calm and he helped me stay calm.
Fundraising still remains an issue. Matt Hawley, now director of the film, has been working largely for free. McGraw says he's crossing his fingers, hoping the film shows the impact of Jim Leedy, not only on generations of artists, but also on Kansas City.
I'm just hoping that it hits the mark.
Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
Leedy, the documentary, debuted on August 31st at the Screenland Crossroads. KCPT is expected to air Leedy, the documentary, sometime this fall. Find out more at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture. And now a closer look inside the studio of artist Jim Leedy. Central Standard host Javelani LaFall recently met up with Leedy to see some of his new paintings and ceramic sculptures. Hear now about how his relationship with the materials is best described as a collaboration.
We are in the studio of the legendary Jim Leedy in the painting/party room. He just had a raucous party here last night from some visitors from Omaha. What's unique about this room that makes this the painting room versus the other room that you enter when you come into the larger studio, which is the ceramics and sculptures room? What's significant about this room?
Well, my clay work in the other room is extremely dirty and dusty. And so I try to separate that, even though I go back and forth. The paintings, I try to keep away from the dust. And so that's why this room is a painting room. And it's also sort of like a place where I have people, you know, and sometimes I spend the night. And my wife is very good, Molly, who is standing here. And she helps me take care of the place. Well, she's saying no, and because she's not proud of the dirt, and she's right, but she does help me in many ways.
Can we bring Molly over here? Can we get you over here, yeah. Molly? How is it to be in this space with your husband when he's working or getting ready to work or he's just gotten finished working?
This is his space, and I leave it his space. Whatever he does is priority here, and I'm in the background unless he needs an assistant.
And what do you do in assistant capacities?
It would overflow your show, but I have some experience with clay, so I can assist him with his clay work, and I know how he works, so I can sometimes anticipate his needs in any of his endeavors.
She's very good at that, you know. It's like I can say, oh, Molly, will you hand me? Oh, thank you. She's handed it to me already. So she anticipates And she travels with, we travel together, and I do a lot of work in the last few years in China. And she's my number one assistant. You know, I couldn't do it without her. She's always there with me.
So when you begin to paint, what is the start of your process like? What do you have any rituals that you go through when you begin to paint, or you just do it?
Yeah, I just do it. In fact, I kind of like to forget everything I have known or done, so that each one is a new exploration, a new adventure. So someone says, well, you know, do you have an idea when you start? Sometimes I might, but I like open canvas and paint and my hands and brushes, and I just start working. I let the painting tell me what to do. I don't tell the painting. It tells me, I put a stroke down. The painting will say, well, don't you need another stroke over here, you know? I say, yeah, what else do you want? Well, how about putting a red color here? It's okay, I'll try that, you know? It's a collaboration with the material and the surface of the painting. Now, I don't know what that piece is going to look like ever. I have no idea. It evolves. It creates itself, sort of, by telling me what to do.
This studio seems almost to be its own sort of living organism by itself, very alive. You got skulls, mannequin heads, and pictures on the wall, African masks, antique indigenous art. What is it like to kind of be present with the space as it breathes and lives?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is an organism in its own right. You know, this room lives, but it lives because of what I have done. You know, it's full of things that I love to have around me. My African mask, my Asian objects, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and I was in Taiwan, and I walked into a shop, and there was this vessel that was there, and it had things growing on it from the sea, and it was nature itself. Some artist 1,000 years ago had made the vessel to store something in, they told me, and on the way from China to Taiwan, the ship sank, and that vessel lay in the bottom of the sea for 1,000 years, and someone found it, and it has sea creatures growing on it and so on, and it was it's much more beautiful now than it was when it was made, because it has collaborated with nature. And that's what I try to do in my own work, you know? I feel like I'm collaborating with nature. Jackson Pollock once said, I am nature, and I understand that completely, because we are nature, and what we do comes out of what we've been, where we're going, what in the world around us. I really, really do try to wed with the world, with the universe. When I rarely ever use paint out of a tube. I make my own paint. I get dirt and I get glues and I get natural colors, and so the painting itself is an organic thing, just like the hillside that might, you know, wash off, and where the water's been and left the rocks exposed and so on. I think those things are beautiful. And I think we can't compete with nature, you know, but we can try to be as close to nature as possible.
artist Jim Leedy in his Kansas City studio. He spoke to Central Standard host Jabalani LaFall. This segment was edited by KCUR's Andrea Salenzi. For a slideshow from Leedy's studio, go to kcur.org.
Coming up, a local rapper changes his message, now leading a not-for-profit foundation and promoting healthy hip-hop. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. In area news this week, after 2 years of trying, peace planters finally got an anti-nukes initiative scheduled on a Kansas City ballot. Testimony wrapped up in the Kansas school funding lawsuit, and there was talk of a major expansion at GM's Fairfax plant. KCUR's Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week.
Unified Government Mayor Joe Reardon had no doubts about the benefits of a possible 400,000-square-foot GM Fairfax expansion.
Not every General Motors plant across the United States remains open or is having reinvestment. And so we know that suppliers will be attracted to this location, which does mean new jobs and new tax base as well.
GM is asking for $120 million worth of industrial revenue bonds for the project. A Peace Planters anti-nukes initiative finally got scheduled for a public vote. It would forbid the city from giving any new incentives for facilities involved in the manufacturing or refurbishing of nuclear weapons. Councilman Ed Ford said the city attorney's evaluation gave the council no choice.
It takes away the only excuse we have for not putting something on the ballot, that being that it's unconstitutional on its face. We have the opinion of the city attorney that it is constitutional on its face.
The council did go on record as not supporting the measure, which voters will decide on in April. A judge ruled that Missouri Secretary of State Robin Carnahan went too far with ballot language on a measure that would stop Governor Jay Nixon from implementing a health insurance exchange without a vote from the legislature or the people. Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder had initiated the suit.
This was not a close call for the judge. He ruled swiftly the same day we had oral argument in his court. It's about as complete a victory for our side as you can have, and it restores the integrity of our process.
The judge rewrote Carnahan's wording that talked about prohibiting people, families, and businesses from accessing affordable health care. A Kansas district attorney concluded that Governor Sam Brownback and some legislators technically violated the state open meetings law by discussing public business at private dinners, but Chad Taylor found no evidence of intentional violations, and Brownback said,
"We took precautions. I mean, that's what I stated to you, and that's what he found in his discussion."
The DA's report did say the legislators needed training about the law and better public notification procedures. Arguments wrapped up in the Kansas school funding lawsuit. Alan Roop, attorney for those suing the state, said,
"When it comes to what the Constitution requires, and that's an adequate education for all kids, we're falling behind."
The state maintained that the funding cuts were necessary to cope with the recession. The Kansas Supreme Court started hearing arguments in a suit by environmentalists over a permit the state issued for a coal-fired power plant.
"The permit authorizes unnecessarily high levels of pollution with serious health consequences for the citizens of Kansas.
Amanda Gooden, attorney for the Sierra Club. Steve Fabert, who's defending the state, said the permitting process was legitimate.
"This is not a rubber stamp process. A tremendous amount of energy and effort went into assembling evidence and providing public hearings and due process."
And a civil suit deposition in a Missouri court caused a stir. A computer department manager for the area Catholic diocese had said that when confronted about lewd pictures on a priest's computer, Bishop Robert Finn said, "Boys will be boys." When the Star published the story, the woman retracted that testimony. This is KCUR.
Most adults realize that kids turn a deaf ear to lectures about what's good for them. That's one of the reasons ex-urban rapper Roy Scott made a series of CDs for kids using hip-hop beats to convey messages about healthy lifestyle habits. He also started the Lend a Hand Family Foundation, a nonprofit that spreads educational messages to youth. This work and his music also dovetail with his day job as an outreach specialist for Blue Cross Blue Shield. Susan sat down with Roy to talk about his work and his journey.
Originally, I wanted to start a nonprofit and I wanted to start a children's book, but I just didn't have any experience in that. And I knew I did have experience in creating music. So I was like, I'm going to just take this music approach to it, take the same beats the kids like, but just put everything clean behind it, like the Hokey Pokey, ABCs, educational stuff. And so the music came first, and I was forming the nonprofit at the same time, though.
You put your left foot in, your left foot out. Hey! And then you shake it all about. You do the Hokey Pokey and you turn yourself around.
How old were you when you started writing music and doing your own music?
I was probably about 12 when I started writing my own music, and then about 15 when I started producing, like, the actual soundtrack and the beats.
Now, your music was a local success, maybe a regional success back then. Tell me about that. But you were into a different kind of hip-hop back
then.
Yeah,
we was into the underground hip-hop. We had some good connects, and we made some progress, but I was just doing the secular side of hip-hop, you know, kind of the more gangster rap. But then just as I grew and started my own family and had children, I was just realizing how influential and powerful music is on me and on people, especially on our youth. So I just wanted to take my gifts and use them to, you know, same hard beats, but just everything is clean, so it's healthy hip-hop now.
So back then you were Mac James.
Yeah, I was Magnificent. I was Mac James, yeah.
And what was the name of the group?
It was Chop It Up.
The Chop It Up clique?
Yeah, the Chop It Up clique, yeah. That was the old school stuff.
Like Yola thought I told you about me chopping the Bundy Tigers. Never could have hated another player. I'm concentrated on paper.
So I have to ask you this. What reaction do you get from, like, old fans or old friends who knew you from the Mac James day, and they're like, Mac James is doing what?
Yeah, well, for the most part, it's been a real good response. I mean, because when you're dealing with kids, I mean, it's really not too much room for, you know, negativity or, you know, or to say something. It's like, well, you're doing something positive for kids. It's like, well, hey, I can't do nothing but commend you for that. And I took the approach of using basically the same beats I was using when I was Mac James. So now the parents, they rolling to the healthy hip-hop, and they like, you know, I kind of like these beats, so they kicking it to it, and it's just a win-win all the way around.
Keeping my grades up, watching my GPA, taking my ACTs, and look, we on our way.
You mentioned healthy hip-hop, and you started to get concerned about the messages. What concerned you?
Well, I was just looking back, on reflecting on myself, and just seeing the things that I was talking about. And these were things I really wasn't doing, but it was what I was listening to, and it started to become me, and I was becoming something that really wasn't me. And it was just very influential on that level. And then I was, again, seeing my kids, they was listening to your popular hip hop artists, and just what was coming across the speakers. It was definitely not healthy. And I was concerned about that and wanted to at least provide a positive alternative to that side of hip hop.
The music came first and then the foundation. Tell me about the foundation, the Lend a Hand Foundation.
Well, Lend a Hand Family, I was just always wanted to do a nonprofit, didn't know too much about it. So I just started doing some research online, talking to some people who I knew who were well-versed in it, and just took the process of getting my 501c3, taking those steps, putting the board together, and just learning as I was going. I was just taking steps in faith. You know, I really didn't know too much about it, but I knew I was just going to get to work, and started growing, and the right pieces started coming together. Just started meeting some good people in the community, connecting with, like, Operation Breakthrough, Spofford Homes, and just Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Kansas City. Just doing work with all these different people, and as we've been growing, just gaining momentum, has been quite the journey. So it's been a good experience.
What's the mission of the foundation?
The mission statement is, Lend a Hand Family is a nonprofit organization that seeks the empowerment of people, protection of family, and respect for cultural diversity. Our mission is accomplished through the use of music, education, and community service.
Well, you know, some would say there's a lot of bad influences on youth today. And what about people who say, well, hip-hop alone really can't influence young people? What do you say to them?
I think that's inaccurate. Just music, period. I don't think it's just the hip-hop genre. Just music in its entirety has a very big impact on just, again, not only youth, just people, period. It influences the way you think. You know, if you take a second to realize, like, what music you're putting inside of you, you'll start demonstrating some of those things that you're listening to.
Now, how does all of this tie into the work that you do in the community for Blue Cross Blue Shield? Or does it?
Yeah, it all ties in together because we actually have an exercise program. It started with just music, but as we grew and evolved, we actually created a full-length exercise program that has a CD, DVD, and a workbook. We're actually working on a children's TV show as well, and just TV you watch on your feet, and it's all just about childhood obesity, but taking a real innovative approach. The stuff the kids like is just reaching today's child, you know, through high-energy fun, stuff that they actually can get engaged in.
I've listened to the CD, and you've written a lot of the messages in the music. What's your inspiration? How did you come up with topics?
Well, I was just really, again, my kids were a huge influence. They really are the ones who kind of been the leaders of this. I've been watching them and seeing how they react to different things they see on TV or that they hear or see people doing. And they were really my inspiration to see, okay, how they react to this. What issues are they dealing with? Like my son in school, you know, they're dealing with new age stuff like cyberbullying, the stuff on the internet. These kids are already online. A lot of different things that they've been dealing with. That's kind of the approach I took was, you know, watching my children.
Let's listen to an excerpt from track 6 where you're talking about being active.
We can do about anything. Let's go outside, make up a game. Come on, let's get some practice. Just go outside, be active. Let's go outside and run and play. Come on now, let's get active.
Tell me about the inspiration for this particular piece.
This again, especially with my kids, you know, he loves to play his Xbox. So I'm like, hey, son, you gotta, you know, get up and do something. You gotta go outside and play. He likes to get active as well. But again, with the childhood obesity epidemic that the country is facing, I just wanted to take that approach to say, you know, kids, we can go have fun. Like, you know, when I was a kid, we was outside, we was making up games and hide and go seek or whatever, just outside getting exercise. Not really knowing we was getting exercise, but we were having fun. So today's child really likes to sit down and play their video games or watch their cartoons. I'm just trying to inspire them to get active, get up and do something.
Now, I think all parents struggle, and I know Michelle Obama and her campaign has recognized this. All parents struggle with the issue of helping kids eat right because they're influenced by so many things in school and in the media. But track 7, let's listen to a little bit of that where you're talking about eating right.
No more cheeseburgers and fries. Nope. I don't want that super size. Nope. Put down those oatmeal pies. Yes. Now it's time to start eating right.
Now, is there something about the music and the repetition of the messaging in hip-hop music that you think is particularly powerful in getting these messages across?
I think it's really the beat. I mean, a lot of times we get caught up in the music, the actual soundtrack, and once the beat sounds good and then you start saying something real catchy, you know, it just starts to stick. You know, when you hear that song on the radio, you may not even like it, but if it's catchy and you hear it a lot and it's like, okay, now it starts to stick in your head and catch yourself saying it and displaying it.
We got to eat right and we got to exercise. We got to eat right.
Now, we just talked about kind of the elementary version of your music that you've done for youth, but you also have a back to school healthy hip hop, which is targeted toward more high school kids. How did that come about?
We wanted to also create something that for all ages. So this is more for like the middle school and early high school. And it just talks about all the issues they're facing, either peer pressuring, bullying, internet safety.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You have a song on that CD called Watch Yourself.
Better not put your phone number on Facebook. Better not put your address on MySpace. Oops, I forgot. Ain't nobody using MySpace. I'm just playing, but for real, I'm just saying, be careful with the information that you're displaying. Watch them statuses. Watch them pictures that you posting up. People in your business and you wonder how they know so much.
Do you find that kids aren't as aware of this as they should be?
Yeah, I definitely think that kids are just, I mean, they're having fun. I know it's a new age of kids. I mean, they're online all the time, but I think they're not really looking at it in its entirety as far as, you know, just how they're representing themselves and the different dangers that are online.
So what kinds of projects, in addition to the CD projects, do you hope Lend a Hand will embark upon?
Well, we're really getting into the educational piece. That's like the exercise program we have for the youth. That's pretty much done. The next piece we're working on is called Represent, where we're focusing on the middle school kids. It's going to be a curriculum talking about, you know, saying no to drugs, practicing abstinence, or if you are having sex, you know, knowing to protect yourself and kind of making them aware of things like that. So that's going to be the goal, is just to create curriculums for each age set and just tie it in with the music and make it real relevant and effective for our kids.
Now, just in general, what do you hear from kids? What's needed? What's missing?
Well, I think what's really missing is these kids really need their parents, or they need positive men and women in their life that are guiding them in the right direction. That's the biggest piece. Other than that, it's just going to take some, just really spending some time with our kids. And it goes, I mean, the programs and everything, those are good and effective, but it really goes back to the home and trying to find a way to encourage our parents to really get involved with their children and see what they're doing. And you can't prevent everything, but at least to just help them and try to, you know, guide them throughout their life.
You can be anything that you want to be. What you say you are is what you're gonna be. So always say you're the best. Prepare your mind for success. And then your wings will grow. You can spread them and fly. You can touch the sky. I tell you right now, the sky's the limit. You gotta work hard from the start to finish. If your heart is in it and your actions follow, you gon' see better days tomorrow.
So, okay, skeptics would say, well, these songs are well and good, but how do hip-hop beats and pro-social messages actually change kids' behaviors?
Well, again, I just think just how influential music is, it's just, it becomes a part of you. So if we can get these children in the repetition of playing not only just hip-hop, but just playing positive music, I think you would see a real difference, you know, in children and in their behaviors over time if you're putting this positive message in them versus, you know, the stuff that they're hearing in today's music. And not only hip-hop, but just, you know, some pop music just is promoting, you know, sex, you know, drugs, just is promoting all these things that are really damaging our kids. But I really think if you took the time to input the right music in them, you would see a big change.
Well, I know Lend a Hand Foundation probably doesn't have an answer for everything, particularly the parenting piece, but what do you think can reach parents?
I think it's just going to take communities coming back together. I think that's the problem now. It's a lot of individuality going on, and there needs to be unity. There needs to be, you know, communities teaming up together. Like they say, take a village to raise a child, but, you know, that village also helping strengthen each other so people can come together and, you know, feel more confident in working together and growing and building something. So I think that's really what it's going to take, is just people unifying and coming together and really, you know, enjoying each other's presence and working together.
So you also perform the music.
Yes, we do. We're doing about 20 to 40 performances a month. You know, myself, Rappin' Roy, and then Reggie Rares, the Magic Man. He's the real high energy, up-tempo professional magician. So we're our most recent, we did the Kansas City All-Star when they were here in town at the All-Star Fan Fest. We did Jiggle Jam. We do a lot of private parties, so we're staying pretty busy.
Roy Scott, president of the Lend a Hand Family Foundation and outreach specialist for Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Lend a Hand Family, Rappin' Roy. This go round, we're talking about respect.
We thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.
Start opening the door for your mothers. Start opening the door for your grandparents. We must look out for the women in our lives. So start now being gentlemen.